3. The 80-20 Breakthrough. Though Stephen Saylor's discovery of the 80-20 rule was somewhat accidental, it appears to be an innovation that he was born to make. Saylor grew up in Texas and Arkansas in the 1970s, developing a passion for science at an age when most boys were more interested in video games. His mother granted him permission to set up a laboratory underneath a staircase in the family home. There he played around with a microscope, test tubes, and other such instruments every day after school. Saylor liked sports too, particularly football and track and field, but he viewed these interests as entirely separate from his scientific endeavors until a fateful day when, at the age of 15, he came across a copy of Jim Fix's second book of running. It contained a chapter called The Scientists of Sport. Saylor read it and knew immediately what he was going to do professionally when he grew up. Saylor pursued a bachelor's degree in exercise science at the University of Arkansas and subsequently stayed on to earn his master's degree. During this time, he took up competitive cycling and got pretty good at it, winning some local races. In 1989, Saylor entered a PhD program at the University of Texas. While he was in Austin, he gave up cycling in favor of rowing, which he was really good at, good enough to win a handful of Masters National Championships in various boat classes. When Saylor was close to completing his dissertation on heart attacks in mice, he attended a meeting of the American College of Sports Medicine, where he met and fell in love with a Norwegian woman. Soon married, Saylor moved to Norway and resumed his research at Agder University in the city of Kristiansand. The most popular endurance sport in Norway is cross-country skiing. Saylor became interested in the way high-level Nordic skiers trained, especially when he observed Olympic-caliber athletes sometimes walking up steep hills to keep their heart rate from creeping above the low-intensity zone. They had what I came to call excellent intensity discipline, Saylor told me. He decided to formally study the training of these athletes, as well as that of elite rowers. Saylor developed a plan to use painstaking data collection and analysis to determine exactly how much of their total training time was spent at various intensities, something that had never been done before. What he ultimately discovered would surprise him and many others. How do the best endurance athletes really train? In one of his early studies, Saylor collected and analyzed data on the training of 12 elite junior cross-country skiers. He found that 75% of their workouts were devoted entirely to low-intensity training. When Saylor mixed all of the workouts together and looked at the actual time spent on each level of intensity, he saw that 91% of their total training time was spent below the ventilatory threshold. In other words, the skiers devoted slightly less than 80% of their workouts to low-intensity work and spent a little more than 80% of their total training time at low intensity. In another early study, Saylor investigated historical trends in the training of elite Norwegian rowers. He tracked changes in training patterns between 1970 and 2001 and found that between these dates, the amount of low-intensity training that the country's top rowers did increased by 67%, while the amount of training they performed at moderate and high intensities decreased by almost 60%. Within the same 32-year time span, the performance level of the best Norwegian rowers, as measured by a standard 6-minute time trial, increased by 10%. By 2001, Norway's elite rowers were doing an average of 50 hours of low-intensity training and 7 hours of moderate and high-intensity training per month. That works out to a ratio of 88 to 12. Saylor couldn't help but wonder if the same pattern of mostly slow training was present in other endurance sports. He looked around for existing studies by other researchers and found that it was. In 1995, a team of French researchers tracked the distribution of training intensities in a group of elite swimmers over the course of an entire season. They found that these athletes did 77% of their training at low intensity and 23% at moderate and high intensities. In 2007, Augusto Zapico and colleagues at the University of Madrid tracked the training of Spanish cyclists on an elite under-23 team during 2 4-month periods. In the first period, they did 78% of their training at low intensity and improved significantly in performance tests. In the second period, they did only 70% of their training at low intensity and did not improve at all. In 2012, Iñigo Mujica of the University of Basque Country monitored the training of elite triathlete Ainhoa Murua as she prepared for the London Olympics, where she placed 7th. Over a period of 50 weeks, she did 74% of her swimming, 88% of her cycling, 85% of her running, and 83% of her combined training below the lactate threshold, which, remember, is slightly above the ventilatory threshold. And runners? In 2001, Véronique Bilat collected training data from elite male and female marathon runners from France and Portugal. She found that they did 78% of their training at speeds slower than their marathon race speed, which, as I've already noted, falls one notch above the ventilatory threshold for elite men runners. In the previous chapter, I mentioned a pair of studies, one also done by Bilat, which produced similar results. When it was all said and done, Stephen Saylor had discovered that elite athletes in all endurance sports do approximately 80% of their training at low intensity. In some sports, this 80-20 rule applies on a session basis. For example, cross-country skiers devote roughly 1 in 5 or 20% of their workouts to high-intensity training, but they spend somewhat less than 20% of their total training time at high intensity because their slower workouts tend to last longer. In other sports, including running, the 80-20 rule applies on a time basis. Top runners everywhere spend close to 8 out of every 10 minutes of training time at low intensity. Despite these slightly different applications of the 80-20 rule, the similarity of training intensity distributions across endurance sports is uncanny, especially when you consider that each sport evolved independently of the rest. As a runner, you might be wondering why you should care that athletes in other endurance sports balance the intensity of their training the same way runners do. The existence of this pattern in a variety of sports provides strong further evidence that the evolution of the 80-20 phenomenon in running was not arbitrary, but instead came about as the optimal solution to the problem of maximizing human running performance. Cycling, swimming, triathlon, and other endurance sports are close cousins of running. Although there are obvious surface differences, swimming is upper body dominant, cycling is non-impact, and so forth, at their core, all endurance disciplines are the same. Success in each of them depends on the ability to sustain aggressive sub-maximal speeds over long distances. The type of fitness that supports sustained speed in one endurance discipline differs only marginally from the type of fitness that does so in any other discipline. Therefore, the training methods that generate maximal fitness must also be similar across all endurance disciplines. The chances that athletes in all endurance sports would converge on the same 80-20 formula by sheer coincidence after starting in different places are next to zero. This could only have happened because the 80-20 formula works better than any alternative in each sport. 80-20 and the Everyday Runner. When Stephen Saylor began to lecture on the 80-20 rule in the early 2000s, he got a lot of pushback from his fellow exercise scientists. He wasn't too surprised. Exercise scientists have long been enamored with high-intensity interval training, or HIIT, and indeed there is plenty of research that seems to suggest that HIIT is more effective than low-intensity training. I'll give you one example. In 2008, researchers at Old Dominion University gathered 61 healthy young adults, translation college students, and divided them into four groups. For 6 weeks, members of one group did high-intensity workouts on a stationary bike 3 times per week. Members of a second group trained more often, 4 times per week, but at a lower intensity, moderate. The third group also trained 4 times per week, but their workouts lasted 50% longer and were done at low intensity. The fourth group did not exercise. Before and after the 6-week training period, all of the subjects completed a VO2 max test, which measures aerobic capacity, or the capacity to use oxygen to support muscle work. Despite spending 30% less time exercising, members of the high-intensity group experienced an almost 2-fold greater improvement in the VO2 max than did members of the low-intensity group. In a 2012 review of existing research on the question of high intensity versus low intensity, McMaster University's Martin Gabala concluded, "A growing body of evidence demonstrates that high intensity interval training, HIIT, can serve as an effective alternate to traditional endurance-based training. inducing similar or even superior physiological adaptations in healthy individuals and diseased populations, at least when compared on a matched work basis. This conclusion is true as far as it goes, but it does not support the notion that a speed-based training approach is better for runners and other endurance athletes than a mostly slow approach. The reason, as Stephen Saylor well knew, is that the studies upon which it is based are far removed from the real world. For starters, the subjects are always non-athletes, never trained runners. How would the results of the Old Dominion study have differed if the subjects had come into the experiment having already developed their aerobic capacity with prior training? Another thing to consider is that a VO2 max test is not a running race. As we will find out in the next chapter, running fitness encompasses more than just aerobic capacity. These are small matters. A much bigger issue is time scale. The Old Dominion study I just described lasted 6 weeks. Runners typically take far more time to build peak fitness for races. Furthermore, the subjects of this study did the same workouts throughout the 6-week intervention. That's not like the real world, where runners increase their overall workload bit by bit. Nor was the rigid segregation of training types like the real world, where most runners who take a speed-based approach do some low-intensity workouts, and runners who practice Lydiard-style training do some high-intensity workouts. But in the studies, it's all or nothing. Saylor felt that his analysis of the training of world-class athletes offered better evidence in favor of 80-20 training for endurance athletes than experiments like the Old Dominion study offered against it. But he recognized that in order to win over the skeptics, he needed even better evidence. Specifically, he needed controlled studies where real athletes trained for real races were placed on either an 80-20 program or a speed-based program, and the results were compared. No sooner had he acknowledged this need than the opportunity to fulfill it came from a Spaniard named Jonathan Esteve-Lenao. Like Saylor, Esteve-Lenao is an exercise scientist, but he is also a running coach and a runner. He's a very good runner, too. With personal best times of 3 minutes 54 seconds for 1,500 meters and 1 hour 11 minutes 30 seconds for the half marathon. He coaches a large running club in Madrid and teaches at the European University of Madrid. In 2003, Esteve-Lenao posed the same question Stephen Saylor had been exploring in Norway. How do endurance athletes really train? But Esteve-Lenao chose a different way to address this question. Instead of simply calculating the average distribution of training intensities in a group of athletes, he wanted to look at individual differences and find out whether runners who did more slow running performed better in races. Esteve-Lenao recruited 8 members of his running club to participate in a study. They were all young, 21 to 25 years, male, and fast, with an average 5K time of 15 minutes 22 seconds. He gave out heart rate monitors to the runners and demanded that the devices be worn during every run for 24 weeks as the runners prepared for the Spanish National Cross Country Championship, a race of just over 10 kilometers. After the race, Esteve-Lenao calculated how much time each runner had spent in each of the 3 intensity zones. Low intensity was defined as the range of heart rates that fell below the ventilatory threshold. High intensity was specified as the range of heart rates falling above another threshold called the respiratory compensation point, where hyperventilation begins. This threshold is a little higher than the lactate threshold, and it occurred at 91% of maximum heart rate for these subjects, which is typical for trained runners. The space between these 2 thresholds was defined as moderate intensity. On average, the runners spent 71% of their total training time at low intensity, 21% at moderate intensity, and 8% at high intensity during their 24 weeks of training. The numbers were not the same for all of the runners, however. Some runners spent more than 71% of their total time at low intensity, others less, and the differences were strongly predictive of differences in race performance. The individual runner who spent the most time at low intensity during training recorded the fastest time on race day, while the runner who spent the least time at low intensity produced the slowest race time. Fitness tests conducted periodically throughout the study period showed that all of the runners became significantly fitter, but those who spent closer to 80% of their total training time at low intensity improved the most. Intrigued by these results, which were published in 2005, Esteve-Lanau decided to conduct a follow-up study to determine whether this correlation was merely coincidental or was actually causal. At this same time, he learned about the work of Steven Saylor and his 80-20 rule. Esteve-Lanau contacted Saylor and asked if he would be willing to help him conduct the follow-up study. Saylor leaped at the opportunity. In this second experiment, Esteve-Lanau and Saylor chose not merely to observe the training of real runners, but to actively manipulate it. Again, Esteve-Lanau recruited subjects from his club. He ended up with 12 young men, ages 25 to 29, with 10K times ranging from 30 to 35 minutes. Six of the runners were placed on a training program that required them to do 80% of their running at low intensity and the other 20% at moderate to high intensity for 5 months. The remaining six runners were instructed to do just 65% of their training at low intensity and the rest at moderate and high intensities. Total training distance was held equal between the two groups, at an average of 50 to 55 miles per week. Before the 5-month training period began, all 12 subjects completed a 10.4-kilometer simulated cross-country race. At the end of the training period, the same race was repeated. The point of the experiment, of course, was to determine which training program produced the biggest improvement in performance. In the initial test, members of the 65-35 group achieved an average time of 37 minutes 51 seconds. 5 months later, their average time for the same distance dropped down to 35 minutes 50 seconds. That's an improvement of 2 minutes 1 second, or 5.3%. Members of the 80-20 group, meanwhile, achieved an average time of 37 minutes 29 seconds in the first simulated cross-country race, and a time of 34 minutes 52 seconds in the second. That's an improvement of 2 minutes 37 seconds, or 7%. The difference between a 2-minute 1-second improvement in race time and a 2-minute 37-second improvement is 30%, which is massive by the standards of competitive runners. Esteve-Lanau and Saylor presented their results in a paper published in the Journal of Strength and Conditioning Research in 2007. They concluded the present data suggests that if the runner can dedicate more time to daily training sessions, it seems better to design an easy, hard distribution of load, increasing the amount of low-intensity training, than a moderately hard-to-hard approach. This left Esteve-Lanau wondering, what if a runner can't or doesn't want to dedicate more time to training? While the subjects of his second study did not run anywhere near as much as elite runners do, their average weekly volume of 50 to 55 miles was still greater than the average runner's training volume. Many runners in the recreationally competitive category believe that by running faster in training, they can compensate for running less. They figure that running 30 miles per week mostly at moderate to high intensity will make them just as fit as running 60 miles mostly at low intensity. Esteve-Lanau and Saylor rather doubted it. They wanted to find out if an 80-20 training intensity balance was also optimal for recreational runners who ran less than the more competitive members of Esteve-Lanau's running club. So they teamed up once again to design a study. Esteve-Lanau went back to his club for subjects, this time choosing 30 runners with average 10K times of just under 40 minutes. Better than average, but far from elite. As in the previous study, the subjects were divided into two groups. Members of one group were asked to do 80% of their training below the ventilatory threshold and the remaining 20% above it. Members of the second group were asked to do 50% of their training at low intensity and most of the remaining 50% at moderate intensity, between the ventilatory and respiratory compensation thresholds. As I mentioned in Chapter 1, research has demonstrated that the average recreationally competitive runner maintains an approximate 50-50 intensity balance in her training. The study was essentially set up to compare the 80-20 approach against the typical training approach of runners in this category. All 30 runners were given heart rate monitors and told to wear them during every run for 10 weeks. Members of both groups ran an average of 30 to 40 miles per week, a training volume that is attainable, if not immediately, then eventually, by most recreationally competitive runners. Subjects in the 50-50 group spent slightly less time running than did those in the 80-20 group, so that the training load, which factors in both volume and intensity, was equal for the two groups. But because those in the 50-50 group did more running at higher speeds, they covered the same distance as the 80-20 group. Before the training period began, all of the subjects completed a 10K time trial to establish a performance baseline. This test was repeated at the end of the training period to measure progress. When the 10 weeks were up, Esteve-Lenau noticed a problem with the data. Most members of the 80-20 group had not done as they were told. Each of them had spent too much time at moderate intensity, which Esteve-Lenau and Saylor referred to as Zone 2, and too little at low intensity, Zone 1. Esteve-Lenau suspected that the fault lay with his allowing the runners to train with fellow club members. "When they run in groups," he told me, "sometimes some of them go at a little higher intensity than the prescribed one." Any runner who has experienced group training is familiar with this effect. The strongest runner sets the pace, and the others follow like lemmings. The experiment was not quite ruined, however. On average, members of the 80-20 group had spent 72.9% of their total training time at low intensity, while members of the 50-50 group had done 46.8% of their running below the ventilatory threshold. So there was still a basis for comparison. As it turned out, the runners who did about half of their training at low intensity lowered their 10K time from an average of 39 minutes 24 seconds to 38 minutes. That's an improvement of 1 minute 24 seconds, or 3.5%. Those who did roughly 73% of their training at low intensity lowered their 10K time from an average of 39 minutes 18 seconds to 37 minutes 19 seconds. That's an improvement of 1 minute 59 seconds, or 5%. Most runners, if offered a choice between a training program that promised to lower their 10K time by 1 minute 24 seconds and another program that promised to lower their 10K time by 1 minute 59 seconds, would choose the latter in a heartbeat, especially if they knew the more effective program was also easier. What's more, the margin of improvement was even greater among six members of the 80-20 group who had adhered most faithfully to the instructions, completing an average of 78% of their training at low intensity. These runners had lowered their 10K time by an average of 7%, which was statistically significant compared to the 50-50 group. Overall, the results of this study strengthened Esteve-Lenau and Saylor's hunch that 80-20 training was more effective for all runners, including low-mileage, recreationally competitive runners. But they came away from it feeling that the case for the 80-20 approach was not yet complete. The Salzburg Study. One of the great things about science is that it is collaborative in the broadest sense. When an individual scientist or a team of scientists begin to publish intriguing new research on a particular question, it is common for other scientists to step forward and add their own contributions. That's a blessing, because experiments like those that Jonathan Esteve-Lenau and Stephen Saylor have done together take a long time to plan and execute. 7 years pass between the publication of their first co-authored paper and their second, which appeared in 2014. If it was up to them alone to see this line of research through to a final conclusion, it would take a lifetime. Fortunately, other scientists have lately taken an interest in Esteve-Lenau and Saylor's work and have begun to make their own contributions. Among these other scientists are Thomas Stogel of the University of Salzburg, Austria, and Billy Sperlich of Mid-Sweden University. Stogel and Sperlich are not interested in the 80-20 intensity balance itself so much as they are interested in a concept called polarized training. The 80-20 method and polarized training are closely related but differ slightly in their emphasis. The emphasis in 80-20 training is placed on maximizing low-intensity training. What's important is ensuring that a full 80% of total training time is spent at low intensity. Exactly how the remaining 20% of training time is divided between moderate intensity and high intensity is less important. In polarized training, the emphasis is placed on minimizing moderate intensity training. Advocates of polarized training believe that the greatest mistake in endurance training is spending too much time at moderate intensity, which is more stressful than low intensity, yet less beneficial than high intensity. Like the champions of 80-20 training, they argue that low-intensity work should account for most of an athlete's total training time, but they are less concerned about hitting the 80% mark. A training program can both be 80-20 and polarized, and in fact, the lower-intensity training program used in Esteve-Lenau and Saylor's 2014 study was just that. The runners in the 80-20 group were asked to do 80% of their training at low intensity, 20% at high intensity, and none at moderate intensity. It was this polarized aspect that Stogel and Sperlik picked up on and decide to test in their own study. The key advantage of the Salzburg study in relation to previous studies was the scope. Its subjects were 48 athletes representing four sports: running, cross-country skiing, cycling, and triathlon. Runners made up the largest block, with 21 subjects. The scope of the Salzburg study was also greater with respect to the comparisons it made. Instead of testing only two training protocols, Stogel and Sperlik compared four. 12 athletes, representing a mix of sports, were assigned to each group. All four groups trained for 9 weeks, but each was assigned its own combination of volume and intensity. The high-volume group did 83% of their training at low intensity, 16% at moderate intensity, and 1% at high intensity. The threshold group did 46% of their training at low intensity, 54% at moderate intensity, and 0% at high intensity. The high-intensity group did 43% of their training at low intensity, 0% at moderate intensity, and 57% at high intensity. Finally, the polarized group did 68% of their training at low intensity, 6% at moderate intensity, and 26% at high intensity. The more training a given group did at moderate and or high intensity, the less total training it did, such that training loads were roughly equal. Before the 9-week training period began, all of the athletes completed a performance test. For the runners, this test consisted of an incremental running test to exhaustion. The treadmill was started at a very low speed of 4.5 miles per hour. The speed was then increased by just over 1 mile per hour every 30 seconds until the athlete couldn't continue. Stogel and Sperlik noted how long each runner lasted and also the top speed he reached before quitting. The same tests were repeated at the conclusion of the 9-week training period. The biggest performance gains were seen in the polarized training group. Their time to exhaustion in the incremental run test, or bike test for non-runners, increased by a whopping 17.4%, compared to 8.8% in the high-intensity group, 8% in the high-volume group, and 6.2% in the threshold group. Maximum speed in the incremental run test, or maximum power in the bike test, increased by 5.1% in the polarized group, 4.4% in the high-intensity group, and 1.8% in the threshold group, and actually decreased by 1.5% in the high-volume group. These results are summarized in Table 3.1, which is found in the bonus PDF. What do the findings of the Salzburg study teach us? Two things. First, they teach us that high-intensity training is essential, but that a little goes a long way. The two groups that completely avoided the high-intensity zone experienced the least improvement. But the group that did the most high-intensity work improved less than the polarized group, which did 2.5 times more training at low intensity than at high intensity. The other key lesson of this study is that athletes generally get more out of time spent at low intensity than they get out of time spent at moderate intensity. The subjects in the polarized group had the greatest imbalance between low intensity and moderate intensity training, and again, they improved the most. This lesson in particular should hit home with recreationally competitive runners, who typically do almost half of their training at moderate intensity. You may have noticed that the group that came closest to doing 80% of its training at low intensity, the high volume group at 83%, did not improve as much as the polarized group, which did only 68% of its training below the ventilatory threshold. Don't get tripped up by this fact. All it really tells us is that doing 80% of your running at low intensity won't take you very far if you never run at high intensity. Also, it's worth noting that the athletes in the polarized group were supposed to have done about 74% of their training at low intensity, not 68%. But as in Esteve-Lanau and Saylor's 2013 study, many of the athletes in this group sometimes slipped into the moderate intensity range when they weren't supposed to. It would be interesting to know if those athletes in the polarized group who spent the most time at low intensity experienced the greatest gains in performance. At least one subject did reach the 80% mark, as was the case in Esteve-Lanau and Saylor's 2013 study. There will be many more studies to come in this fascinating line of research, and they will further clarify our understanding of how to train most effectively for the sport of running. but already we know enough to train more effectively than we ever have before. Today, there are still coaches who place a heavy emphasis on high-intensity training. It is now clear that this is a mistake. Other coaches advocate lots of moderate-intensity training, which is how most recreationally competitive runners train anyway. We can now say with certainty that this is a mistake as well. Thanks to the pioneering work of Stephen Saylor, Jonathan Esteve-Lanau, and others, we know the best method is aiming to do 80% of our training at low intensity and devoting a fair portion of the remaining 20% to high-intensity efforts.